From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
With the explosion of interest in native plants in recent years, I know I'm not alone among gardeners who are scouring catalogs and specialty nurseries looking for the right native to match every garden purpose, from trees on down to ground covers. A new book by Uli Lorimer, Director of Horticulture and Native Plant Trust, has added some plants to my wish list, including some native annuals, and even has me pondering diversifying my lawn with some violets and hunting down a few more native vines, and oh my goodness. So more in a moment, but first these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now. Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Uli Lorimer, author of the just-published book, The Northeast Native Plant Primer, has made a career of working with native plants. He was longtime curator of the Native Flora Garden at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and in 2019 became director of horticulture at Native Plant Trust, America's oldest plant conservation organization, which was founded in 1900 as New England Wildflower Society. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so pleased to be here.
Must be beautiful at Garden in the Woods and Asami Farm and all your places there.
Yes, spring is definitely happening, and there's so many things coming out of the ground now. I was just remarking that this is one of my most favorite times of year, as there's that fresh green all over the carpet of the forest, and
yes,
little tinges of fresh green leaves coming in the leaves of the trees. And I always find it's a time of full of promise for the gardening season ahead.
Yeah. So before we get started, I should say we'll have a book giveaway of the new book, and congratulations on that, The Northeast Native Plant Primer, with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. We'll do a giveaway. So you've been working with native plants since when? And did you ever imagine a moment like this where they've really finally become kind of the it thing? You know what I mean? Where they aren't an alternative, they're a mainstay more and more?
So, I mean, I started my interest in native plants sort of professionally goes back to my days at Wave Hill, actually.
Oh.
And I was their woodland gardener there, and probably spent more time pulling out invasives rather than natives, but it was sort of the beginning of my sort of formal interest in them. Wave Hill, of course, exposed me to a sort of dizzying variety of other kinds of plants for which I have fond and great appreciation for. But it feels very satisfying to sort of be at this moment where the momentum that we've slowly been building over the last 10, 15 years has really gathered speed. And I think that the past couple of years particularly have really opened folks' eyes to how important it is to include natives in their gardens.
And do you think there are sort of headline kind of reasons, or, you know, current event reasons, or what do you think is what's the awareness that's, do you think, that's mostly spurring that?
Not to say that good things came out of a global pandemic, but I do think that the circumstances forced a lot of people to stay home and to, you know, if you were fortunate enough to have a garden, to really take a hard look at it and say, hey, look, this is something really special. And then that coupled with this, you know, ever-growing drumbeat of kind of bad news about climate change, the anxiety that people feel around what the future holds, along with the sort of bad news about the loss of biodiversity. And whether you're talking about birds or insects or pollinators, there's lots of different ways that we've measured this. And then seemingly every week there's a new article talking about declines in some way. So I think all of this sort of adds up to people really wanting to do something to support the environment, to do, you know, what they think is right, and turning to the plants that are, you know, in their backyards and in their local parks seems like a logical choice.
Right. So the book, which is very timely for the reasons you're just talking about, is arranged by plant group. So, you know, there's 235 different plants, from trees and, you know, down to like grasses and sedges and rushes, and in between wildflowers and shrubs and ferns. Ferns are one of our common favorites, and we've talked about that before on the show. I especially loved a section that was in on native vines, which frankly I hadn't even thought about, and except it turned out I had a bunch of them here in the garden, and I never really thought of them quite the same way until I read the chapter in the book. But there's also a section on annuals, which off the top of my head, Uli, I probably couldn't have named any native annuals. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, we think annual, zinnia, marigold, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the book provided a kind of unique opportunity to expose people to the fact that we actually have real true native annuals here. And I think that for many gardeners, when we think of annuals, we're actually really thinking about plants that are not cold hardy here.
Right.
Olds, these things are all there. They may be perennials in warmer climates, but we plant them for summer color and as bedding annuals, with the understanding that they'll turn to mush as soon as we get a hard frost.
Right.
And that's sort of an important distinction, because true annuals are part of nearly every flora. And these plants have evolved to you know, germinate quickly, to cover ground, to flower freely and early, and to make as much seed as possible, because that's how they return the following year. And so I find them as a really useful group of plants in gardens, because for those very reasons, they fill in around tough spaces, but you can't think of them or conceive of them as, you know, long-term members of any kind of design. They're here for a short period of time. They move around, and sometimes they pop up in just the perfect place, and then sometimes maybe not the perfect place. And so they're easy to keep if you need. That, you know, it brings a sort of uncertain degree of serendipity to the garden that I think is really lovely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are, I don't know, seven or so in the book. And I mean, I realized I only had like two of them here, and I didn't even know most of the rest of them. I mean, one other one I knew, and the rest I had never even heard of. So, the ones I knew were Herb Robert, I think that's Geranium robertianum, is that right?
Yes,
great. And over the years I've read about that and questioning whether it's native or was introduced a bazillion years ago or where it's from, and I've never really gotten a clear picture, but I guess you've done some more homework.
Well, as I understand it, it's one of these what we call circumboreal plants.
So yes,
really broad distributions in the northern hemisphere. And you can find them in Siberia as much as you can in Europe, and in Canada and in North America as well. For dry shade situations, it's a great plant.
Beautiful leaves. I love the leaves.
Leaves are great. You know, some people, the flowers, if you crush them, it has kind of a cilantro-like fragrance to it, which I've always felt pretty, you know, pleasant. I know some folks don't like the smell of cilantro, it for me is one of those things. When I have to edit it out, I always kind of enjoy the aromatic experience.
Interesting. And then the other one that I knew was, and we should say, the purple, the flowers are kind of a lavendery color on Herb Robert. But the other one I knew, and everyone probably knows, and actually at the moment I'm doing some editing, because it's very distinctive. Seedlings are just popping up through the surface here where I garden in the Hudson Valley of New York, is jewelweed.
Yes.
A native impatience. And
yes.
So give us the pitch for jewelweed, because I think a lot of people just yank it all out, but...
Well, so it has tremendous wildlife value, I think it has just lots of wonderful little stories. The flowers are wonderful and complex looking. They attract hummingbirds.
Yes.
You know, if you like cardinal flowers and trumpet vines to attract hummingbirds, they'll come and spend lots of time around a jewelweed patch just as much because of that long nectar spur that wraps around in the back of the flower. It is a host plant for other things, and it likes, you know, damp places. If you have kids, there's this really wonderful activity. One of the common names for jewelweed is touch me not, because the seeds are, what are called explosively dehiscent. So if you touch them, they literally explode and eject the seeds out away from themselves. And so I find that's just a wonderful activity, with young children to get them engaged with dispersal and all these wonderful stories. To have them go through the patch and, you know, touch a seed pod and watch it spring to life. It was really fantastic. One of the other things that I really liked, just as a quick side note, sometimes in the spring you'll find little seedlings of jewelweed tightly clustered together.
And that's what I was going to say, is it's like a little bouquet coming up together. You know what I mean? It's just like so tight, and it's just like, what happened there? Who did that?
So that is the activity of our delightful white-footed mice. And so the mice collect the seeds and hash them all in one place. And then, of course, they forget, or the plants germinate. Whenever I see those tight little bouquets, I think about, you know, a sort of industrious little mouse that season before collecting the seeds in the ground and maybe eating a few and creating a little store for the winter. And it always brings a smile to my face when I see those little clumps. Randomly distributed.
It reminds me of someone was telling me, we were talking about Trillium. I was talking about Trillium with someone, another one of your loves recently. And mm-hmm. She was saying sometimes out in the wild, she'll see like sort of a perfect circle of Trillium. And those were seeds deposited by an ant. So here are our mm-hmm. animal partners doing the planting, right?
Yeah. You know, and I grew up with Beatrix Potter stories. And so this is sort of the same kind of idea that I can imagine, an industrious little dormouse or white-footed mouse going about their lives and collecting seeds. And I think it just it connects me to my childhood in a really
Right. So one that I don't grow but is in the list of native annuals, Rudbeckia hirta, the black-eyed Susan. Now that's something that people will conjure a mental image of pretty easily. So that's an easy one to grow.
Yeah, it is. And you know, there's some conflicting information about whether it's actually really an annual or a biennial or even a short-lived perennial.
Right.
But you know, it often gets used as sort of a cover crop when people establish meadows, because it germinates quickly and it has these really, you know, big showy flowers that are you know, very attractive. The seeds later on in the fall are you know, greedily gobbled up by songbirds and goldfinches. And again, once you learn to recognize the seedlings, you can either let them, you know, run free and have a beautiful display, or edit them out if you feel like. So, you know, I think it's and it's good for, you know, sunny areas, disturbed areas. You know, they don't want to grow in, you know, the same soil that your vegetables grow in. So if you've got gravelly soils or tough, you know, poor soils, this is a great choice.
Mm. Among those that I really didn't know, I'd heard about partridge pea, but I've never seen it in person. I don't even know the genus and species, but partridge pea, tell us about that.
Yeah, so partridge pea is a bean family member. Again, it's more broadly distributed in the, you know, Midwest and prairie states, but does make its way into the East here. And we've got two species here. The one that I've listed, it has larger flowers. There's another species called Camacrista nictitans that has smaller flowers. But they, you know, again, true annuals, they germinate quickly. the pollinators absolutely go nuts for the flowers. You know, we use this at Daryl Morrison's suggestion as a cover crop when we established the meadow at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. And there were, you know, and I was that the first year it was all partridge pea, and I was really worried because we had sown all these grass seeds and I didn't see anything. And the shade that plant created was actually sort of a nice little nursery for all of the grass seeds. And within 2 or 3 years, the partridge pea was sort of pushed to the edges, and, you know, became a little bit more sporadic. And that whole experience really helped me to understand how useful annuals are in garden design, and that particularly if you're doing new installations and you don't want to worry about lots of weeds, things like partridge pea are great. And their seed pods are also explosively dehiscent. Yes, they, you know, like bean pods, they have little square little seeds, and they will split and sort of twist like a propeller blade when they're dry. And on, you know, really warm days in August, you can sit by your plants in the sunshine and hear this little popping noise as the seeds disperse. Just really, really wonderful. It sort of brings a little, you know, auditory experience into the garden.
And it's almost like a little bushy, shrubby creature with lots of yellow flowers up and down.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of, again, in Brooklyn, we had a lot of visitors from Central America and places where the sensitive plant, mimosa plant, grows. And people used to think, hey, is this it? And they would touch it, expecting the leaflets to clasp together. So it has that same sort of delicate look to it, but it's a really tough plant. And again, for anything that has, you know, poor soils, well-drained soils, and initially not a lot of competition, it's a fantastic cover crop and a great pollinator plant.
Huh. Now, one I've never heard of. I mean, I don't know where you came up with these, Uli. I mean, really, it's funny because sometimes, I mean, I may have never seen a plant or grown a plant, but a lot of times I will have come across it in the literature, or someone will have mentioned it in a slideshow or whatever. But Old Field toad flax. Nuttallanthus canadensis, maybe?
Yes, Nuttallanthus. So we have a number of native flax plants. They're related to the European flaxes that are the source of linen as a textile. And so this plant similarly has the same sorts of fibers in the stem, but, you know, you'd have to get, it's very labor intensive if you ever want to make any linen out of this. But it's a really delightful early annual that I see all over the place on roadsides and, you know, sort of highway, the little clover leaves, the on and off ramps, you know, just the little tinge of blue. They're just really wonderful little plants, and they have a flower that's very similar to a lobelia. So good for early pollinators. And a favorite of our native bumblebees. And it, you know, it makes a whole lot of seed. So really just need to introduce it once in your garden and you'll probably get recruitment year after year after year.
Huh.
It's an unknown plant, you know, if you're not a botanist, that I think could really use a lot more exposure in horticulture circles.
And then the one that for me in the annual chapter of the book won the prize for the, well, actually maybe there were two, these last two, for the great common name is the blunt-leaved rabbit tobacco.
Yes.
I don't even know how to parse that.
Well, I mean, you know,
smoking
aside,
rabbits.
who makes the
common names.
The Latin name is also a huge mouthful. So we use this plant also at Brooklyn Botanic Garden as part of our sort of cover crop mix. And it's very simple to Pearly Everlasting or Sweet Everlasting.
Oh.
In fact, as a cut flower, it's a good like dry cut flower, like sort of like those Everlastings and straw flowers. It has this really wonderful aromatic foliage. As I said in the book here, it's kind of reminiscent of maple syrup in a way. And I remember very distinctly an encounter again at Brooklyn Botanic Garden on a warm day in August. A man and his son came in, and the son turned to him and said, "Daddy, it smells like pancakes in here." And they were like, "I'm hungry." And it was this, you know, they didn't know where the smell was coming from. It was a combination of sweet fern of Comptonia and this rabbit tobacco, just kind of commingling to suggest a nice warm pancake breakfast with syrup on top.
I think the last one in the annual group is forked blue curls, which again is one I've never heard of, and has sort of a purpley blue flower, maybe.
Yeah, it's a mint family member.
And
so it has also really wonderful aromatic foliage is sort of pleasant when you crush it. And then the styles of the flower are sort of a big curl, a big round curl, almost like an eyelash, which is why it gets its name. And again, pollinators, particularly our smaller, you know, solitary nesting pollinators, absolutely love this plant, and will greedily visit it. And as you can see, the image in the book shows that it's quite floriferous. The flowers will drop, but new ones will come. It's a great one for pathway edges, for rocky slopes and sandy soils. There were other annuals that I had wanted to include in here too. I think overall, one of the hardest parts about writing this book was limiting it to 235 plants.
Of course. Yeah. Well, and as I said in the introduction, I mean, you have other sections. I mean, you, for instance, in among the wildflowers or the perennials or whatever, you show a couple of different kinds of violets, and, you know, and it made me think, it made me remember, you know, people are constantly ripping out violets, and yet which are not an annual, which you know are so important, and I thought, yes, I have to really, you know, be happy that I have so many, and I think you even suggest, maybe, or you've suggested to me in the past, that we could even like encourage them in our lawns and so forth, and diversify the damn grass, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the violets are a perfect addition to any sort of lawn planting. They grow relatively low, so they don't mind, you know, if you mow over them occasionally.
Right.
And if you do let your lawns go a little bit longer, particularly in the springtime, you'll get a wonderful show of either dark purples or blues or white colors. And you know, it's an important resource for early emerging pollinators.
Right.
They're a wonderful, diverse group. Again, you know, if you feel like there's too many, then you edit some out.
Right.
Fill in around all of these wonderful, you know, tough spots. They pair well with sort of stronger growing clump forming ferns and other sorts of woodland perennials. And I just find them really delightful and cheery.
Yeah. Well, and so in the last 2 minutes here, I just wanted to shout out one of the things in the vine chapter, because, you know, I knew some of them, I have some of them, the perennial kind of vines, Dutchman's pipe and the wild yam, the Dioscorea, the trumpet honeysuckle. I have those in the garden, Lonicera sempervirens. But that crazy wild cucumber.
Oh, yes.
I thought that was like a weed. So Echinocystis, I don't even know, Lobeta. Tell us about that, because is that an annual?
It is an annual.
Yeah.
It's another annual vine that, that again, likes, you know, the edges of wetlands and hedgerows and anywhere where it can have good consistent moisture. The foliage is very attractive. It's a, you know, cucumber relative. So it has that, you know, sort of almost star-shaped leaf.
Yes.
And then it makes actually two different, it makes separate male and female flowers. And they're wonderfully fragrant. I see this commingling with the Clematis virginiana often. It's just my friend Dan Jaffe grows this on a fence line at Norcross, and it's just a wonderful, you know, you can train it to go up really anything that it can ramble onto. And, you know, I think it's just, again, another great member of our flora that most people don't know about.
Well, and again, I thought it was a weed. Do you know what I mean? It's so robust, and it sort of comes out of nowhere, and then whoosh, it covers entire shrubs, and you see it along the sides of the roads and stuff in hedgerows, and you think, oh, that must be an invasive, you know, just because so much stuff.
Well,
there
I mean,
is,
that's
right,
and it that kind of growth pattern where you know, terminates quickly and then grows very vigorously just to make more seed is exactly what annuals do.
Right. Right.
And you know, it's a plant that if you have a little bit more space to let it ramble, it's certainly one that you can welcome in. If you have a smaller garden space, there are other choices that might be a little bit better.
Right. Well, Uli Lorimer, again, I say congratulations on the Northeast Native Plant Primer, and we're going to have a book giveaway with the transcript over on awaytogarden.com, the transcript of the show. And I'm always glad to speak to you, and I'll give some links to all of this good stuff. We'll have an illustrated transcript so people can see some of these lesser known things in the photos. And thanks for making time today. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yes, thank you so much. Always
sure.
Speak with you, Margaret. Thank you.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, small gift books illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of this show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.